Susanna. And she's not there. Well, I'm very much here. Giles Brown with you live until 12 o'clock.
This is Frank Bruno. You listen to Giles Brown on TRE.
Thank you, Frank. Right then, unsung. Been looking forward to this one as well. The untold stories of sports hidden heroes. While sports' biggest stars and household names enjoy the glory, Unsung celebrates first-hand accounts from over 40 unheralded heroes, offering illuminating insight to behind the scenes of professional sport, featuring previously untold stories from a cast of characters including F1 pit mechanics, kit designers, doping officials, rugby medics, and many, many more. The book is called Unsung. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK by Alexis James. Alexis, good morning to you.
Hiya, Jazz. How are you doing? Enjoyed your air guitar there.
Well, hey, you know, if you can't air guitar, and it was it was Santana, so it was actually air bongos. So that's, you know,
okay,
you couldn't see if
the air guitar is up here.
Just to let you explain, he's not in the studio with me. We're actually, by the miracle of modern 21st century, we're live on a Zoom link to each other. We hear all about, you know, the multi-million deals, the Beckhams, the Usain Bolts, the Lewis Hamiltons, but we never hear about what Shankly would have called, you know, the bootroom boys, do we?
That's exactly right, Giles. And lovely summation of the book there. I'm not sure you need me now, but essentially it's called Unsung, and it's the lovely tagline is "Not all heroes wear kits," and it is told from what I like to think a fresh perspective in sport. So you're not getting anything from athletes, coaches, or even the fans here. So you're getting stories from people who provide such an integral role behind the scenes that they're almost always taken for granted. Some of these roles, some people may not even know exist. For example, you've got your Formula One mechanics, you've got athletic starters, so obviously the guy who just fires the gun.
Yeah, now.
You've got you. Sorry, go on.
That, you see, that's the, because you've got the guy, and I'd forgotten about this, but of course, you know, you've got not just a guy who fires the gun, and that must be, and you know, is that a role that you think, okay, when I grow up, I want to be the guy that fires the gun after I take this meeting? Because that's a career and a half. But you've got the guy who disqualified the most famous athlete on the planet, Usain Bolt.
That's right. Yeah, he's a chap called Alan Bell. He's a very charismatic fella. He doesn't live too far from me, actually. He lives in Cumbria. But yeah, he used to be a high jumper, but he describes himself as a knackered athlete. So he had to retire in the 70s. And he was asked to go along to, he was a bit down and despondent about his life. And he was asked by his club to go along. And what he thought he was going to do was judge a high jump event. But actually, he was just handed a couple of guns. And they said, right, that's the next step in your career. And 45 years later, he remains the highest ranked chief starter in the UK. He's been all over the world. And as you say, although I should say, before he disqualified Usain Bolt in 2011, he was there in 2009 in Berlin to see the big man break the world record, record that still stands today. And then 2 years later, he was in Daegu, South Korea. The world was watching again, expecting Bolt again to break the record. But unfortunately, Alan fired his second gun, which is he only fires that when he hears a beep in his ear, which is when somebody's false started on the sensors.
Now you've just blown my mind there for a minute, because you've just said he's the top rank starting pistol person. Now that is a league table that I never even knew existed.
Yeah, well there you go. You'll have to get the book, won't you?
So
you get starters at youth and local level, and then they progress to national level, so they can do any events at sort of national level within the UK. But Alan is the international star. Not only that, he educates and goes around and tutors and teaches starters all over the world. He went to Tokyo about three times before the Olympics last year to tell them the intricacies and the techniques required to fire in a gun. And it's more complex than you might think. He takes his job very seriously. It's all voluntary, I might add. He spends a lot of money doing it alongside his day job, although he's now retired. There is a trick and a technique. He talks about the chemistry between the eight sprinters and him, and knowing when to fire the gun, knowing when to say set, having to know all individual athletes' mannerisms to know that the showmanship isn't going to spill over into gamesmanship, so that, you know, each race is won by a feats of athleticism rather than unsporting tricks of the mind, if you like.
Sure.
So yeah, you've got to be, and in 2011 he had to be that guy who ruined everybody's night, who said, no, actually Usain Bolt has, you know, he's jumped the gun and he's got to go. And the funniest thing about that story is, less than an hour later, Alan in Korea, the most unpopular man in South Korea, went to the VIP area to meet his wife, as he did after every day.
Yeah.
At the bar, sat with his wife, was Mr. and Mrs. Bolt. And he couldn't believe it. Looking over, he saw, oh my God, I'm going to have to speak to Usain Bolt's mum and dad's here, you know, just minutes after disqualifying him. So it could have been a very awkward exchange, but... by all accounts, it went all right.
The thing is, though, I mean, I know it's, oh my goodness, he disqualified Usain Bolt. But if the guy's broken the, you know, if he's inadvertently broken the rules, it's like saying, okay, well, you know, Ronaldo should have scored that goal. He was a little bit offside, but hey, it's Ronaldo. The rules have to apply to everybody, don't they? I mean, you can't just say just because you are the most famous athlete in the world doesn't mean that you get a free pass. It's sport, not showbiz.
Well, that's true, but I mean, Alan's got a few tales to tell on some countries, and I won't name them here, that maybe do let some of their biggest names off at this stage. But Alan's very resolute in the fact that it doesn't matter who you are, you're not getting a pass. I mean, even on that night in Daegu in 2011, you had Michael Johnson on commentary saying Bolt should appeal here. He could say anything. He could say there was a bang in the crowd if somebody coughed. In it, you know, even someone like Michael Johnson was saying, Bolt should appeal. We need this guy in the race. It wouldn't have made any difference. Alan would have said, jog on, lad.
Yeah. jog on being the operative words.
Exactly,
we're talking about, you know, officials and athletics. And it's interesting you mentioned athletics because, you know, that's quite humorous, but it varies. I mean, you look at the dark side and that's doping. And I, a couple of years back now, I interviewed Lance Armstrong's teammate because he'd written a tell-all book. And I was, you know, I mean, I thought I knew my way around the world of sport, but the world of cycling was absolutely a look into a parallel and dark dimension about what was going on I can't remember the team. It must have been Sky, wasn't it, Lance Armstrong? I can't remember the team anyway.
It was the Postal.
US Postal, excuse me. Apologies.
I think the chap, he must be, is that Tyler Hamilton?
That's the one, yeah.
He wrote the Secret Race. It is a great book, actually.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do with this book was, it's meant to be an ode, a love letter to these people behind the scenes who don't often get the credit. So I was very wary of doing a chapter on doping because, you know, it's not a cheery topic, or at least I didn't think so when I first started. So I was a bit reluctant, and actually I found it quite difficult to find anti-doping officials who were prepared to talk to me because, as you can imagine, they sign their lives away, and, you know, there's... Despite what the authorities say about hoping that the process is transparent, you know, it's still quite tricky to get anyone to talk on the record about the whole thing. But I did manage to track down a chap, very helpful chap, who was actually an official in cycling. He was retired in his job as an anti-doping official, and so therefore was unencumbered by any sort of contractual restrictions or anything like that. So he told me quite a few stories, and actually... you know, at the heart is, obviously it's a dark topic, but there were some very light moments in there. And I'm not sure, given the time of morning it is, I can go into too much
detail. Yeah, I know, yes.
Talking about prosthetic genitals, you know, guys who pass off their wife's urine as their own only to find out that a pregnancy hormone turned up in there. So, you know, you had a cyclist being told that the good news is you haven't been taking any performance enhancing drugs. The bad news is you're pregnant.
There's genius.
A few stories in there that this chap who you know, spent almost 40 years at the heart of anti-doping. And yeah, I mean, there's a positive outlook to it as well, because in the book I talk about a chap called Robert Goldman, who was a physician who surveyed 198 or something like that, athletes in the 80s, and asked them if they could take a magic drug that would ensure that they'd win every single competition they entered, but it would kill them in 5 years. More than half answered yes. So that was back in the 80s.
Mm.
Obviously, there's been 30 years of real progress in this field, and the fact that we talk about the likes of Armstrong, and, you know, these people do end up getting caught. The majority of them do end up getting caught. And in 2013, that same study was done again, And again, they studied around 200 athletes. And only two said yes this time. So there's definitely been progress in the sense of, you know, athletes who maybe think twice about putting this stuff into their systems now, because, you know, I think one of the first ever examples of a performance enhancing drug was a guy called Tom Hicks at the 1904 Olympics. It was the marathon, and halfway through he was really struggling, and his coach just came up to him and just plied him full of brandy and high doses of what's called strychnine,
mm-hmm. which is a poison.
We use that these days as rat poison.
Yeah.
So, and it wasn't illegal then, by the way. That wasn't against the rules. There was no sort of anti-doping rules in place. So he's still rightly, Tom Hicks, the guy, is rightly the champion from 1904. And it was all fueled by this stuff. But, you know, that hopefully that's not happening as much. And it's thanks to these tireless anti-doping officials behind the scenes who have to essentially... extract the urine from these athletes and in some cases blood as well.
Indeed. Let's moving on from that, and there's a mention of somebody I've had the pleasure of spending the evening with, and his brother Tom and Max Evans, the Evans brothers, who are to put it mildly, a good laugh when you go out with them. Max is now based down in both international rugby players for Scotland, both handsome chaps. Max is now living in the Algarve. Tom is living the dream over in Los Angeles with Nicole Schroeder, whatever her name is, the Pussycat Godol. But it very nearly didn't happen because it was the Millennium Stadium, Scotland v Wales, and he had an absolutely horrendous rugby injury that almost cost him his life.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is mentioned in the last chapter in the book, actually, which is all about rugby medics. And yeah, as you say, there's a doctor in there called Dr. James Robson, who anyone who's followed Scotland rugby and Lions rugby over the last sort of two decades really will be very familiar with. He's an amazing guy, and yeah, he was basically responsible for saving Tom Evans's life in the crucial minutes on the pitch. And it was 2010, I think it was Six Nations. And yeah, Tom, he'd been off previously, about 5 minutes previously, because I think if I remember right, he cut his lip. So he went to get stitches on his lip, came back on. And then because he was conscious of his lip, he went into a challenge completely differently as he would have normally done. And he ducked his head even further in to try and protect his lip. Mm. And it ended up in this really sort of horrendous collision. Caused a potentially life-threatening spinal injury, it takes a lot to keep the Millennium Stadium quiet on Six Nations Day, but the sight of a neck brace did exactly that day, and it was Dr. James Robson's actions in those, you know, few seconds really when he realised what was at play here, and he said, "Don't move him, don't give him painkillers. If you give him painkillers, He might loosen up and start to move himself." And it ended up in an emergency surgery. Obviously, Tom Evans ended up having to retire, but he owes his life to Dr. Robson. And as you say, it's not a bad life at the minute.
No, indeed. I remember him saying to me, you know, we finished the dinner. He was like, "Let's go on." And I'm like, "No, I'm going. I know you guys. I'm going home." And I'm very glad I did. There are so many hidden heroes, though, aren't there? I mean, the guys who make the artificial snow. There are the guys, you know, there are groundskeepers. There are you know, coxswains. And this is the thing. It's not the money, and it's not the fame. And in a culture where we live in a selfie and you know, I want to be next to celebrity, people don't get into this for a fleeting glimpse of Beckham's ankle, do they? They get into it because they believe and they love what they're doing.
Well, that's it. I came up with a proposal during one of the lockdowns. I wrote the book over a couple of lockdowns, and it just felt the right time to write it because, you know, we had that COVID sentiment of, you know, where we were rightly lauding the NHS and care home workers as superheroes, but also you had these other, you know, this subsection of society that were now deemed these key workers, and they were rightly finally getting undue credit. You know, you had delivery drivers, teachers, supermarket workers, you know, the public transport workers. And I guess it was with that kind of sentiment in mind that I wanted to write this book, but give that sort of the sports treatment. And these people are, you know, they've not only got great stories because they don't often get asked about them, let's be honest, but they're also the best at what they do. They're either the best at what they do in the country, some, as we mentioned with Alan, the best in the world at what they do. So they're passionate about their sport, and they're passionate about talking about it as well. One of the things is that they don't see themselves quite often as service personnel, as we might look at them. You know, you take the Formula One mechanics.
Yes.
These guys don't see themselves as the driver's walking, talking toolbox. They see the driver as an additional component to get to their, where they want to be. And that's what I found fascinating. You know, that they just look at the driver as one last piece of this equipment that's going to go around and get them. And when they talk about their highlights of their career, they talk about wins, podiums and points in the first person, you know, as if it was their win, which it is in truth. You know, they put the car together, they put it through wind tunnels and they go through testing and they make all the tweaks and changes. And most of the top Formula One drivers acknowledge that as well. When they cross the finish line, they always thank their backroom team.
The thing is with that, that's why I have an, because my father was a professional racing driver, so I've grown up around this sort of thing. And it's interesting because the Constructors' Championship, and I won't go into my full F1 mode because you know, the TRE listeners know this, but that's why the Constructors' Championship is more important to them than the Drivers' Championship, because it's for the whole team. But they
and because that's where their bonus comes from as well.
Was it? I mean, did quite a lot of these people that you work with go, well, why do you want to write about me? Because I'm not normally on in front of the TV.
Do you know what it is? Actually, no, they didn't. I think they were initially surprised at the initial outreach when I got in touch with them. But when they started talking, because they're so passionate about what they do, and in many respects, they're so confident that what they do is can't be done by others. They're delighted to speak about it. They didn't need a second. And the other thing is as well, you know, speaking with a journalistic head on, these guys haven't been media trained. You don't get your questions vetted. It's warts and all. It's really quite refreshing. You know, and there's no problem with access, you know. I mean, the only problem with access I had was because it was during COVID. But as soon as the restrictions were loosened, all of these guys were inviting me to their homes, to their places of work. You know, I went down to Banbury to see the Haas F1 headquarters.
Didn't meet Gunther, did you? That would have been interesting.
Unfortunately not. He was away, but I met the mechanics and they were good fun.
So what was the, I mean, we're talking about the profane, i.e. Gunther and the Haas team, the sacred chaplains. Now, this is an interesting, the spiritual aspect of modern sport. Alexis, explain this one to me.
Yeah, I mean, the way that the chaplains describe what they do is they describe it as being spiritually, what was it again? Pastorally proactive, spiritually reactive. So they're very... You know, they're very keen to get across that it's not God squad here. We're not Bible bashing. You know, if you want to talk about religion and you want to bring that into your sport, by all means, they will do. They'll go through their favorite Bible passages. But actually, what they're about is just providing a pastoral service, someone there to be able to speak to at your lowest moments. Now, whether that's when a team's been relegated, when there's redundancies, or which blew my mind, by the way, at the Olympic Games, chaplains turn up and they will have people just go up to them, and even though they've never met them before, they will, you know, they'll trust them with their deepest, darkest secrets.
But are these chaplains, I mean, do you have a chaplain, you know, attached to West Bromwich Albion? I mean,
so for example, in
other football teams are available. I just pulled West Brom out of a hat. It could have been Port Vale, not, you know, Sunderland or something, you know?
Yeah, well, I think West Brom need a chaplain at the minute. They certainly need somebody to speak to. But yeah, so usually team sports will have, it's certainly more common now. It wasn't back in the day, obviously, but it's more common for there to be a chaplain embedded within that team. So they'll be there several times a week. You know, you can chat to them about anything, about losing your place in the team, not having enough transfer kitty to your dog died that morning. Whatever it is, it's separate to what a psychologist, you know, a sports psychologist may usually talk to them about. But then, yeah, these sort of one-off sporting events like the Olympic Games or the Commonwealth Games, you have these chaplains who arrive en masse, and they usually set up a tent somewhere, and they'll welcome anyone from fans to the athletes to coaches to go and basically bare their soul to them. And you know, I've got tales in the books where athletes have turned up and said, if I don't win a medal this weekend, I'm going to lose my funding. I'm not going to have a way to make a living. You know, but on the other end of the scale, the chaplains were very keen to point out that it's not just the bad news to deal with. They, you know, it's they hate going to visit in hospitals because anybody, any athlete, injured athlete thinks, oh God, I didn't realise I was that bad. Last rights time. Yeah. But yeah, it's, you know, they you get a lot of athletes want to, you know, they've just won a medal and they don't really know what to do next. So they go and they decide, well, I'm going to speak to the chaplain. I'm going to speak to God. You know, what? It's a fascinating section.
We've got Father Help Us. We've got Man City away next week in the cup. What was the?
They were strict about that. They said if anyone asks them to pray for a win, we're not allowed to do that. We can pray that you do your best, but we can't pray against the other side.
And it's football. It's the wrong game, as we know. The Lord's is the oval ball. Anyway, let's move on. What was the most surprising stroke, heartwarming stroke? I mean, apart from the fact there's a league table of people to hold the starting game, which has blown my tiny mind, Alexis. What was the one that made you sort of sit back and went, that's an absolute peach?
Good question. Blimey. You know, I think the ground staff actually are in there. I mean, obviously, the ground staff feature on the front cover.
Yeah.
And because the thing is with these guys is you imagine them as these kind of, you know...
We had them at school, didn't we? We had them at school, well, groundsmen.
They've got a you know, grumpy groundsman reputation. I mean, for example, one of the guys I met is a fabulous fella, Yorkshire guy called Tony Stones, and his nickname was Thundershorts.
Thundershorts,
which tells you everything you need to know. And he regaled me with stories of, you know, scrapping with goalkeepers and whatnot. And you just think, oh, well, it's the stereotypical view. But actually, as the chapter progresses, you realise that these groundsmen have changed completely. And I should say ground staff, by the way, not groundsmen.
Of course, indeed.
And you know, they've changed. They've become agronomists. They've become scientists. I went to visit Leicester's amazing new training ground. It was last October. It's like cost 100 million to build, and they've got a UK, the first ever sports academy in there, and they've got a doctor of turf. You know, they've got a laboratory in there. You know, they've got these. I went in; it was like being back at school with all the Bunsen burners and the labs. But the reason is they measure the exact firmness of the pitch. They know the exact length the pitch needs to be, so that, for example, Jamie Vardy can run as quick as he can, but not too firm so that the defenders can't catch him. Do you know what I mean? So they've, I mean, obviously it's not working for them this season.
Exactly, but, yeah.
I guess it's that element of where the roles changed, you know. So I met these ground staff, and even Tony himself, I joke about him being the archetypal sort of grumpy groundsman. But this is a guy who was at Wembley, who transformed Wembley's pitch, and then got a job at the Stade de France at the Euros in 2016. This is a guy who doesn't speak a word of French. And he's got some great stories about his time there, about him accidentally killing off half the pitch and having to paint it green the night before the opening game at the Euros, giving it the just for men treatment every night with nobody else knowing. And then also there's the time, you might remember during the Euro 2016 final, when that plague of moths, or the locusts, sorry, and one landed on Cristiano Ronaldo's nose, and it sort of went to Gary Lineker, and he said, oh, it's because the ground staff have left the lights on overnight. Well, when I mentioned that to Tony, I can't repeat the language that he
was it fruity? Was it fruity?
It was a little fruity. Yeah, it certainly had a few F's in there. But needless to say, he refutes that that side of the story, and he puts his side across in the book.
The book is called Unsung, The Untold Story of Sports Hidden Heroes. It's by Alexis James. Alexis, if people want to find you on the socials or on the web, and I could have talked to you for this in the next couple of hours, but I'm going to run out of time. Where can they find you? Do you do the social media thing? Is there a website?
Yes. So there's a website, unsungbook.com, and there's also a couple of socials. So there's @unsungbook on both Twitter and Instagram. So yeah, check out that and you get some updates on the book. There's also I'm working on a podcast. Ooh. Aligned with the book as well. So there's an extra cheeky plug there, if you don't mind.
You plug away anything with the Doctor of Turf, I think, has got to be. I mean, I'm looking for that one as well. So, yeah, I think Doctor of Turf is a badge I could wear with pride. This book is called Unsung. It will be available as a download from the TRE Virtual Bookstore. The book is called Unsung, The Untold Stories of Sports Hidden Heroes. Go forth and check it out. And we look forward. We also look forward to the podcaster as well. Alexis, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much.